All right, I hope everyone's back. Welcome. And I see we have a few people from the recent intro class, so a special welcome to you. So we'll start this evening talking about this link independent origination from birth to death. So this cycle of selfing, of suffering. The last 2 weeks ago we talked about birth as this as one of the cycles, and how can we work with that? And one of these inconvenient truths of our world is that birth is always followed by death. It always follows inevitably. That birth leads eventually to a sense of aging, of decay, and death. And one of the interesting things about dependent origination is that we can take it from different time cycles, different time frames. So we've been focusing mostly on the frame of the moment by moment arising of the sense of self and how the whole mechanism that creates that and how that creates a level of suffering and how we can choose to work with it in a way that actually loosens that suffering. So there's in this way of looking at it, which I think is very helpful. Each moment, each day, there's many arisings and passing aways. Arisings of self-identity, of opinion, of who I and why I'm right, why you're wrong. All these things arise and they also pass away. It happens so quickly we don't always notice the deaths, the passing aways. But dependent origination, we can zoom out more to even the stages of our lives. You know, the stage of life when maybe you've gone through your formal schooling and you're starting your first job, or that stage when that job ends. And there's a new beginning, a new career, or when you come to retirement. There's ways that our self-identity really gets invested in these roles that we take. Those of us who are parents, there's a way that that's constantly changing from the newborn to the preschooler, to the middle schooler, to the high schooler, to the college student, to the young adult, to the adult that's left home. All these are different ways that that self-identity changes, and there's little mini deaths in that. There's deaths of our physical ability. You know, thinking back to what we used to be able to do, our health, our strength, our speed, and how that also changes. Sometimes gradually, sometimes very drastically. These are also births and deaths. Being able-bodied to being disabled. And then, of course, then there's our life itself, this whole spectrum from the day we're born to the day we die also can be seen as this large cycle of dependent origination. And it might be helpful for tonight to zoom back to this larger cycle and use this as a way to explore this link of death, because it's such a powerful spiritual teaching. It's such a way that informs our spiritual journey and also how we live in this world in reference to the fact that the life is finite. And it helps by doing this, it can help us inform how we meet those moment by moment births and deaths. How can we actually bring more energy, more intention and attention to those moments to actually see how moment by moment, we have a choice of acting in a way, responding in a way that creates more suffering or starts to lead towards suffering, or toward freedom, I should say, toward wisdom. How they can create ignorance or wisdom. So about a month ago now, I decided to visit the dermatologist for the first time because I grew up in the Southwest and had some sun exposure, and I'm starting to get older and figured it's better to, you know, catch anything sooner than later. Didn't have anything particular to be concerned about. But the doctor, being very thorough, found a mole that he was a little concerned about. And he said, okay, I advise getting a biopsy. And I was like, well, could we just wait? But finally I realized, okay, he's thinking maybe it might be melanoma. And I thought, well, let's do the biopsy. And it was a quick procedure. And as those of you who have gone through this, you know, in about a week, we'll let you know. You know, so you have this thing looming over you, this, you know, what's going to happen? Is this, is this the big diagnosis, or is this just a mole that is no big deal? You know, and that I think that's a common experience, especially when you get to a certain age, that you start to have that. Or you maybe you've experienced it with loved ones who've had those kind of brushes, those potentially serious diagnoses that they have to wait for. And what do we do in those times when it's with ourselves or with our loved ones? How do we meet that? Because it's, if you're like me, when you hear that, it's like those old cartoons of, I think of always the Road Runner and Wile E. Coyote, and how the coyote would be running after, go off a cliff and be kind of going in space a bit before they realize there's no ground underneath them. And like, that's the same way that these brushes, these potential fatal diagnoses land on us. We have this assumption that our life is going to continue on in the same way it has. We have our plans that we've set us, we've, we're accounting on. And suddenly that ground is no longer there, and we come to this screeching halt where we have the potential to quote a bit of Naomi Shihab Nye's famous poem, Kindness, just the beginning part, that before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. All this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. This is a poem that my teacher Rodney used to read almost every retreat, and just in the middle of the retreat, hearing these words, and it goes on from there in a very beautiful way. But that sense of the future that we held and so carefully counted and saved, having that dissolve, having that fall away. Right? So when we have, like, as I experienced that week of waiting for what that report would show, what the biopsy would show, it was that sense of the future dissolving. And in that, I realized I had a choice, as we all do. We have these two main choices of how to be with this, of how to work with it. Choice one is to go toward contraction, toward the fear, the terror, the denial, the resistance. The other choice is to turn toward, to learn, to release, to surrender. And of course, we have a combination of these that we go through, we cycle through different parts of these. And part of these are actually the healthy part of the grieving process, the denial, the resistance, the bargaining, the trying to negotiate. These are all healthy ways that the mind tries to accommodate things which have really dissolved the future in a weakened broth. So after this biopsy, this very, 30-second procedure, I was left waiting to see for this week what would happen. And I was curious, okay, what is my mind going to do with this? How is my mind going to react to this? So of course there's the things you have to tend to and worry about, but there's this, well, how is my mind reacting to it? So I decided to actually kind of increase the energy around it by deciding to spend that week not knowing, to hold not knowing the fact that this might be the one, to actually take it in that this might be the one diagnosis that leads to my death, that this might be the event that I've been denying, ignoring, overlooking, that actually might have suddenly arrived, the beginning of the end. Kind of skip over all the treatment and the prognosis and just assume it's going to be fatal, as a way to kind of play with it a little bit. And of course, some of us, that's, we don't get a chance to play with it. It is the diagnosis, which is very dire. And if that's your situation, please, I'm not meaning to make light of that. So in this week of contemplating and observing, it was like turning toward death as an advisor, turning toward to see how do I live? How would I change the way I live? How would I change the way that I relate myself and the world? And I always appreciate these lines from Carlos Castaneda's books when he talks about using death as a advisor. And to quote him, that you have to be aware of the uselessness of your self-importance and of your personal history. Your death can give you little warning. It always comes as a chill. Death is our eternal companion. It is always to our left, at arm's length. How can anyone feel so important when we know that death is stalking us? The thing to do when you're impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just happen to have the feeling that your companion is there watching you. The issue of our death is never pressed far enough. Death is the only wise advisor that we have. So having this kind of medical scare is like catching a glimpse of this advisor, catching a glimpse of the fact, the hard, unpleasant fact of mortality. So I was particularly interested to see if, you know, I only had, let's say, 6 months to live or even 6 years to live, what would I change? What would be different about how I was living my life? If I knew life was limited, you know, would I stop this activity or this role or this job, or I start something else or something different? And I was surprised and also a little, I guess, relieved to realize that the basic structure of my life, the basic activities, didn't seem to need a lot of changing. I mean, there certainly they would change, you know, if things, my physical health got worse and worse. But it was much more the relationship to experience, the relationship to how I hold myself in relationship to the world. Because what became so important was how I lived, how I related to life, and in particularly how to be fully available to life. However it is presenting itself right here in this very moment, whatever the moment might hold. Spending time with my wife, with my daughter, spending time in nature, you know, just waiting in the grocery line. It has that power of transforming everything. And I also see what held me away from that. One of the patterns that I had no more time for, is no more time left to keep indulging, to keep engaging unconsciously with. And that was particularly around the self-doubt. The sense of the deep assumption of inadequacy, the worrying about how I'm perceived, how am I liked, am I doing enough, am I good enough? All those deep voices that I think many of us struggle with. And to realize if this really was the end, beginning of my end, I wouldn't have time for that. The energy would fall away. And it was surprising to realize that something like this, and I think as anyone who's really has that, which probably most of us do, it's painful. And we don't like that it's there. And yet it keeps churning away. It keeps continuing. Yet when I held this question to my face, this reflection that maybe this is the end, suddenly there is the energy to let that drop, to let that fall away. So the energy to keep picking it up is the energy of dependent origination, is the cycle of suffering, of all those links that we've slowly gone through over this year. This is the process that keeps churning again and again. And so it takes tremendous amount of energy, of urgency to start to let that go, to see through it. And that's what death can be a gift for that. Especially these kind of brushes with death that we can look at and see, or if we do have our own death is a reality. If it's actually in front of us, I think there's an urgency and a sincerity of practice that arises from that. And the paradox is the question was, what is keeping me from fully living? Fully living right here, right now. As that poem I read at the end of the sit. When it's over, I want to say all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. These beautiful lines from Mary Oliver's poem, When Death Comes. So in this way, brushes with death are gifts. Brushes with our mortality, those false alarms that wake us out of our slumber, wake us up out of our habituated way of being in the world. And sometimes we realize, oh, this activity, this role, this relationship, this job, it loses its significance in the face of my death. Other times we see that, oh, this role actually, it really deeply resonates with something that's so vitally important. If I only had a limited amount of time to spend this world, I would choose to spend it this way. And I think even more important than what we do is how we do it, is how we are relating to each moment, the mundane, cleaning the kitchen, taking out the garbage, to, you know, being with something that's very immensely spiritual, immensely powerful. So I actually think we're lucky when we have these brushes with death, especially the slow ones, the ones that we have to wait. And there's this unknown at the end. And there's kind of a finite time that brings enough energy to look. The surgery that finds the tumor is benign while we're waiting for that surgery and we're waiting for the results. That's the moment. The waiting for the lab results. That's the moment that this urgency can come up. They help us reprioritize our life, to reorder our life. You know, it teaches us to be a bridegroom, taking the world into our arms. And it also helps us prepare for the real one, not the one that's not a false alarm, which will happen with each one of us at some point. We may not be able to see it coming. It may just simply happen. Or it may be something that we can see and have a chance to prepare for. But we don't have to wait. As Carlos Castaneda said, turn to our left and see our advisor and ask. Take that suggestion. Like, you know, these teachings often are when you're not faced with something that, you know, that has that kind of intensity, it seems like it's really interesting to look at, to be with. But when you have that diagnosis, it's a whole different matter. It's like you have a different level of engagement and energy at it when it's really at stake. Like the five reflections, the five wise reflections that the Buddha suggested people do, whether they're lay or ordained, whether they're a woman or a man. Reflect that I am separate to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. I am subject to illness. I have not gone beyond illness. I am subject to death. I have not gone beyond death. And I will grow indifferent, separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. And I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions. And I have my actions as my arbitrator. These five reflections, you know, particularly the fact that, you know, that this body will age, this body will grow ill, this body will eventually die. It brings that level of interest, that level of urgency that's so needed to pierce through the delusion, to pierce through the power of our ignorance. And that's why our practice often struggles, because there is such a strong momentum. And this cycle of dependent origination, you know, each time that cycles through, it deepens that groove, it deepens the power of the ignorance. And these brushes with death are again our gifts. Often reflect that, you know, ideally we would have a brush with death every 10 years or so. You know, there's diagnoses that were, you know, it's scary enough to really get our attention and reevaluate our lives, to reorient our lives. So we can have a chance to turn death into a wisdom. So there's these two choices that we are faced with, that we have in front of us. The choice is again to deny, to fight, to push against, to resist. Again, part of this is human nature. Part of it is the natural and almost necessary accommodation to these difficult facts. But whether we stay stuck there, we stay held there, or the other choice is to open, to release, to surrender, and to act from that, to act in a way that we're aligning ourselves with what we deeply believe. And actually, this choice, you know, I kind of step back, zoom back to look at this, the sense of the whole lifetime and those scares with death. To go and look at it to see how, in more clarity, how this moment shows up in each birthing that we do in each day. Each day there's many, many births, many, many deaths that happen. It happens in all these time frames, from the different roles of our lives to down to these very microscopic almost births and deaths. We can see it more clearly from the perspective of, oh my, this is my whole life is about to end, versus something like just that fantasy ends or that mind state ends. And perhaps seeing it in those kind of in between cycles, those different roles. You know, when we're a parent and our kids don't need us in the same way, becoming more independent, as you know, as my teenage, almost 17-year-old daughter is becoming more and more her own person, growing into an adult, and doesn't need that, you know, that support and nurturing that I spent most of my life with her giving her. And so there's that choice of releasing that birth, that sense of identity, that role. And yes, it's painful. Yes, it's not always comfortable to see that role pass away and a new role arise. You know, imagining, you know, times in your life when you've really committed to a career or a course of training or an education, and how that has its own kind of birth, its own kind of life. There's all in the middle of it, there's the robustness, there's the excitement, and at some point that changes. You know, it changes eventually. Maybe it hasn't changed yet for you, and maybe it has because it was time to retire, or that job just went away or wasn't needed, or you were replaced. Our health is another, you know, very deep teacher. And when we reflect back to when we were in our prime of our youth and had the strength and energy, if we were lucky enough to have those periods, that's not always a given, is it? And how, as we get older, we're not as quick, not as strong, our endurance fades. These are all the life's showing us this fact of impermanence, of change. And all this is shown up microscopically in the moment-by-moment births and moment-by-moment deaths. And if we look carefully, we can see how this whole, all these other cycles, the other 10 cycle links in dependent origination, keep this whole process churning. Now, from dependent origination, the key thing to remember and to realize is that death leads to suffering. Okay, so there's the big suffering, yes, of the grief of our loss of our life, of our roles, but there's also the suffering that's kind of that microscopic suffering that we sometimes just glance over because we're so busy going to the next thing. It's like we're the I had a friend who said, you know, he didn't know if he ever was really hungry because he always ate too soon. You know, it's like that sense of that hunger we quickly reach out for, whether it's something we want, is an object, an experience, whatever it might be. We're quickly going to the next thing, driven by craving, by tanha. That's why independent origination, when you go through, if you're watching, look in the suttas, it goes through all the different cycles. On the very end, after birth leads to death, the end of the formula is, and thus the arising of this whole mass of suffering. And thus the arising of this whole mass of suffering. Is when we cycle all the way through from ignorance to becoming to birthing to death. And there's this thing that happens as we go through that cycle of dependent origination. It's often called the outflows, like the result, kind of what gets generated. And those ones are called sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. You just sum them all up as suffering. Right? Sometimes we suffer when there's a beautiful state of being, a state of mind, a state of identity ends. You know, we rejoice, we welcome, we appreciate when it's present, and when it ends, we grieve, we experience that loss. Other times, the mind state itself is painful. It's a hell realm on earth as we are caught in our self-doubt, our self-hatred, our anger, our fear, and it's so gripping. And it's painful while it's present. And as it ends, there's a relief. But both of those are constantly causing this pattern of suffering, of sorrow, of lamentation, of pain, of grief, of despair. This is our normal way of reinforcing this pattern. This is our default. This is our habitual way of being with it. That's when we're resisting and fighting with death, resisting and fighting with the ending. And this choice is our habit. It's our conditioning. It's really our momentum. And we have done this in countless ways. We've done this today in countless ways. And each time we cycle through it, we're constantly deepening and strengthening this momentum of dependent origination, strengthening the selfing, strengthening dukkha. This is strengthening the momentum of suffering. The reason this is that each time we go through the cycle and there's the suffering at the end of it, that then leads back to ignorance. That reinforces ignorance, which think back all the way back to January. That was the very first link. Ignorance, the blindness, the delusion, not understanding how things actually are. The basic confusion about the nature of things, you know, particularly around the three characteristics of we take things which are impermanent as changing and flex as and full of change, arising and passing away, we take them as being permanent. You know, how could we not suffer in that way? When we take our health as being everlasting, when we take that identity, that role as being everlasting, eventually that will be stripped away. I mean, how many people this year have had dreams stripped away by COVID? Plans, things that you've carefully counted on, that you looked forward to, that you saved money for and set aside time and anticipated. And then COVID happens and it's stripped away. How many people had plans for Thanksgiving that have suddenly dissolved because of the governor's urging to protect public safety? You know, these forces come through and strip us away. And not understanding that things are impermanent. It's our confusion about them that creates suffering. Dukkha, you know, is taking that which is sati you know, inherently unsatisfactory, unsubstantial, as being substantial, as being inherently fulfilling. This is the definition of dukkha. It's very related to impermanence. And then my favorite, you know, anatta, non-self. We take something that we think is solid and not changing, the sense of me, the sense of identity, the roles I have. And those roles change, or they get attacked or questioned or undercut. And then I feel that tension of having to defend against. or they get enhanced and supported, and there's praise and there's fame, and then the role gets bigger. And each of those I take as being solid and unchanging, and yet they will change. I think that's one of the marks of a mature human being, is the willingness and ability to see that things change. The willingness to say, okay, life is different now. You know, I used to be a rock star and now I'm not. You know, now I'm, you know, I'm just a Joe nobody. And that sense of that fluidity. You know, I used to be the most important thing in my child's life, and now I am maybe fifth in the, on the list or something after, you know, Snapchat and what's the one she leads Lex a lot now? Is it hip hop? No, I forget the name. Anyway, the, she'll kill me if I'm talking about her like that. So she, luckily she doesn't listen to these talks. But anyway, so you know what I'm saying. Yeah, TikTok, that's it. TikTok, exactly. Someone who's sophisticated in the realm of that stuff. So it's like their priorities change, you know, and that sense of self doesn't like that. And yet that's, how can it be anything different? So this is the ignorance that drives this whole process. And if we're not paying attention to how we die, how our deaths happen, we recondition the ignorance. We, you know, convince ourselves that, you know, things are permanent, things are lasting. The sense of me is lasting. There's satisfaction and lasting fulfillment and stuff, which is inherently not. And that creates suffering. It sets up this whole cycle. It sets up how we orient to the world, how we name the world, how we relate to the world, how we perceive the world, how we, the sense of Vedana comes up, the sense of liking or dislike, or the pleasant or unpleasant, I should say. Then in going to the craving, the clinging, the liking and disliking, and that whole movement of hardening toward and away. So birth, death, these outflows of suffering and ignorance that starts the cycle and reinforces it again and again. So this is the first choice. This is our normal way of doing it. That's why, you know, death is such a powerful teacher, because it helps us start to have a grip, a sense of urgency to see through this power of delusion, this power of ignorance. And this is where the second choice comes through. This is where the poems that I've read tonight point to. That when death brushes up against us, and we're not caught immediately in our fears and our terror, even just for a few moments, something opens up, a state of wordless wonder. I remember when I was younger, one of the first experiences I had with death up close was I was a ranger up in the Forest Service, and a hunter fell off his horse and, you know, really crushed his head. And I was trying to, you know, minister first aid, but he ended up dying. And, you know, helicopter came in, you know, there's all those details. But even in the midst of all that trauma, all that intensity, I remember just looking out across these hillsides with the eyes had seen, are seeing differently. There's a way that the beauty was so apparent. Even with the grief, even with the shock, there's still that something fell away, a sense of separation between me and nature. It's like sometimes death has that power of stripping away that separation, stripping away the illusion of separation. So then there's just the connection. There's just the immediacy of life, this profound stillness, the access to beauty. And then the shock maybe comes in and that becomes predominant. So it often goes back and forth. And so, you know, working with these brushes, you know, pondering the fact that we too will die. This is a fact of life. It helps us to see something falls away. Something falls away that keeps us separate and isolated. This is the small, the conditioned self. And then the deathless starts to be seen. Because this is we spend most of the night talking about kind of the predicament, the difficulty, the problem. But the whole reason the Buddha described this and taught it was to see through it, to see the end of it, to see what he called the deathless, what is outside of aging, outside of birth, outside of death. And it's not like some heaven realm. It's not going into a different heaven state that we sometimes have in some religions, including Buddhism. There's also this, the hell realms and heaven realms. But those two, the Buddha clearly said, were dukkha. They also are impermanent. What he was pointing to is this cycle of suffering, the cycle of ignorance, becoming the seeds to create the sense of self. When that's replaced by wisdom, the sense of self doesn't arise. It can fall through just as a taste, as a moment, as a kind of a hint of things just aren't as solid as you took them to be, to falling away in such a profound way that it's unshakable and does not change, becomes the new way of seeing the world. And for most of us, our practice is learning to navigate, to explore that, to see that more clearly, because it is the ultimate solution to this suffering. It is ultimately the third noble truth, the end of dukkha. Dependent origination is the origin of dukkha, how that arises. And the deathless, what is beyond condition, with outside of change, is something that is always here, always available. We just forget to see it. We forget we have our ignorance keeps us aloof and tied up from that. And so each moment of birth, each moment of arising and the death that comes from that is a choice point. Do I choose to go into what leads to more ignorance, to more suffering, or do I choose to turn toward what leads to wisdom? And I think I'll just conclude reading that poem again by Mary Oliver, When Death Comes. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy and as singular. And each name, a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body, a line of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. When Death Comes by Mary Oliver. All right, can we just sit together in silence for a few moments? In a few moments, we're open to questions or comments or sharing. I would just go over the homework for this week. So the homework this week, so Sorry, just catching a note from the tech support person, Ken. Okay, so this week, use death as an advisor. Notice the small deaths that occur many times during the day. How can you relate to those deaths in a way that leads to wisdom? So I'll put those in the chat for you. So this week, use death as an advisor. And notice these small deaths, these small endings that happen every day. I mean, it may just be a shift, and we don't often notice it because we shift quickly to the next thing. So start to slow down and see that enough. Well, I'm no longer happy. I'm no longer angry. I'm no longer doing this or that. Notice the small deaths that occur many times during the day. And how can you relate to those deaths in a way that leads to wisdom? Right? So this is your riddle to try to solve, to struggle with a bit. You know, you can find the ways that relate to it that actually increase the suffering, and the ways that relate to it with that lead to wisdom. And so next week we'll have a chance to kind of unpack that with some kind of small group interaction, as well as a recap. All right, so we have a chance for any comments or questions or sharing you like to do, and you do have permission to unmute yourself. So go ahead and do that if you'd like, and we can dialogue.
Tim?
Yes. Hi, Lauren.
Thanks for telling the story with death as your advisor over your left shoulder, just so specifically that as it relates to your life, because it really came alive for me. And that idea of death as an advisor and looking at death and the way you did it was very, very powerful. So I just wanted to thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else, Lauren?
No, that's all. But I now have this image of death over my left shoulder accompanying me. And and then I have the example of the way you actually did it in your real life. So it's something that I can feel that I can go forward with myself because of that. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, beautiful. And I think particularly when you're kind of struggling with life and just, you know, confused, you know, turning toward that advisor and asking your death, what in that perspective, that this is a limited, finite life. Sometimes, you know, as I think Carlos said, a great amount of trivial things is dropped.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Lauren. All right, Katie, you like to go ahead and mute yourself?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tim. I really related to so much of what you were talking about. I feel like a lot of this has been on my mind lately, but I was thinking in particular about these kind of small deaths along the way. I feel like that's happened. I mean, it happens all the time, but especially during COVID, that's become more apparent as, I mean, just like for so many of us, like so many things in my life have changed, like more than ever before. Yes. But I noticed that with that, I'm whatever's kind of feels like it's left from, like, I don't know, I think of it as like my old life or something, like who I was before COVID, anything that's like, luckily I still have my job, but I've noticed that I'm clinging more to those things. Like I'm kind of like, I'm trying to cling to something, like some kind of life raft, because there's like very few things that haven't changed, but that's also creating more suffering because just because I have my job right now doesn't mean I'll have it tomorrow. Or just because I have a certain relationship right now doesn't mean I'll have it next week.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of the tempering that we need to do with this kind of a spiritual question around asking Death an advisor, because it, we often need to have that place of stability, you know, and when life kind of, there's an old saying that sometimes we go to the monastery and sometimes the monastery comes to us. And there's those things being stripped away by a world struggling with COVID, things have been, it's like that monastery has come to you and it's taken things away. And so learning, you know, that naturally we want to find that place of stability, like, okay, well, here's, at least I have my job or this relationship or these things. And of course there was that willingness, that wanting to kind of cling to those and, you know, like a life raft, because everything else is changing. And so, you know, we need to be gentle with that process. And so one way to kind of help bridge that is to find, okay, what in this very moment, you know, if I kind of let go of time, let go of the future, let go of the past, right here, right now, what is there that seems to be stable, seems to be reliable or unchanging? You know, it might be as simple as, oh, I can feel my feet on the ground. I can sense my breath going through my body. And that gives you this kind of moment by moment place of stability. And then, you know, you look at something like the jobs, like, oh yeah, I appreciate that I have this job. I feel lucky to have it still. And yeah, there's no guarantees what will happen tomorrow or the next day. And that, but notice how that goes into the future or the past. And then really that's kind of one of the hints around working with death, is that the more we go into the future or past, the more frightened we'll get, the more knocked off our feet or more obsessed we're going to tend to get. But when we come into the immediacy of this moment, I mean, what's, you know, right now, I mean, it looks like you have shelter, you know, it looks like you're comfortable, you know, and that's just like with me right now, there's shelter, there's comfortable. I can relax into that fact of this moment. And so it's like learning to find that, okay, in the midst of all this change, there is something that is, you know, what is more stable here. And that can help us start to even relax deeper to that very way of relating to the moment. So I don't know if I hit your question. You want to talk a little bit more, Katie?
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. I think part of it too is I noticed I was clinging. So there was that. And like suffering on that, but then also I was kind of beating myself up because I'm like, well, you need to don't cling to the job or don't cling to this person, like kind of let it go. So that was like just layering on the suffering with that as well.
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes the learning is seeing, what does it feel like to cling? I think that's also a really helpful way to look at this, that we so much focus on the content. I have a job or I don't have a job. But there's that, the clinging itself is almost more of a generic phenomenon that we plug different things into cling and crave to, right? And say, okay, what does it feel like to really want this, to really not want this to change? You know, so you know, I'm just gonna, since what I'm saying is that you set aside the details for the moment. You have to attend to those, of course, but also you can learn a lot by just seeing that movement of wanting to hold on to. And what does that actually feel like? And that teaches you a different relationship to suffering, to understand it more directly, more immediately. And then once you start to get more of a sense of that, it's an interesting thing that our lives' decisions, the way we act in the world, starts to free up, because we're not so kind of unconsciously driven by craving and by clinging. We know, oh yeah, I prefer that I have a job, but I also, I'm not clinging to it. So then I'm much more able to navigate, you know, whatever change happens.
That's helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Katie. All right. Looks like Marquez.
Marquez. Yeah.
Marquez. Good to see you again.
Likewise, good to see you. I guess just barely graduated from the intro class. So I'm happy to be here and just kind of like listen and contribute ad hoc. And I guess something that I'm just listening to you all had just kind of brought up to my mind. I had to get on a plane a couple of days ago and I had to come on home. I had to come back to Texas for a little bit. And you know, this concept of like birth, aging, and death, and like trying to just like, you know, play with certain things. Like, I'm a big chicken when it comes to like hopping on a plane and, you know, like, you know, being in the air for too long, you know, like, so something that I tried to kind of like play with is like, you know, like if you feel that turbulence or if you feel that like those experiences on the plane, it's like, you know, like, can you really like sit with this? And like, you know, like if it were to be the day that like this plane went down, you know, like, would I be able to like hold it? And I don't know, you know, I've been doing, you know, a lot more meditating lately. You know, I just thought in my little old mind that one day I was going to, like, I was just going to be able to, like this, kind of, like, be like, ah, you know, like, you know, plane's going down, like, it's going to be my day. Man, that plane, man, we hit the slightest bump, and I was, you know, like, I was grabbing on to things, and, you know, like, it just showed me something that I don't think that, you know, at least intellectually, like, today, and I think I'm okay with it, and I know it's kind of something to kind of, like, work with. I'm still clinging, and like, I'm, yeah, I don't want to say like I'm not ready, but I'm not, but you know, like right now it just feels like, there's just a lot of like baggage there, and there's a lot of things to hold on to, whether it's your life or whether it's your relationships or whether it's your job. And something that I'm just learning from you and Tawere is like, you know, like, and I've experienced it and I feel the physical pain. Like sometimes when we hold on to things, it just hurts, you know, like, and you want it to last forever. But something I've been kind of like grappling with is, I have a tendency sometimes when I let go, it's almost like, okay, like nothing matters, you know? And I hear this term like deathless. And you know, like, I'm just wondering, like, you know, like I find it like myself intellectually, like, I don't know if I can truly, sometimes I'm looking for an intellectual purpose, right? Because I guess that's just the way that we've all been brought up. You know, I want this fixed mindset to tell me how this life is going to work and how these things are going to work. Was there ever a point in time in your practice or anybody's practice where you just realized like, okay, like the mind is just like a wave now and it's just like flapping everywhere and I don't really know how to I see everyone pointing to this like this deathless thing and I'm trying to understand it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm trying to understand it the wrong way. Am I making any sense to you?
Yeah, you are. So the tricky thing about the deathless is that our conscious, normal, rational mind can't comprehend it. It's like it's a completely different paradigm. It's just it makes absolutely no sense from the normal paradigm of a sense of self, the sense of the relationships to thought, because it's a place where there's no thought at all. I mean, thought doesn't even have any grip, and the deathless. It's like this. You can just see how it's also has a sense of deep interconnection because there's no quality of separation, and so that for most people, you know, including myself. You know, it's kind of it gets very frustrating because we're trying to find it through our normal strategies, right? We're trying to use our mind to find it because that's all we have. That's the only strategy we know. We have to almost kind of keep exhausting all the possibilities and seeing how it's not working. And here's a secret out, you know, something I found is very helpful. Like going back to the plane, you know, and feeling that, you know, okay, how, am I going to be like, okay, this is okay, or am I going to, you know, have that terror come up? And of course, when the terror comes up as a meditator, you think, okay, well, I messed up. I wasn't as good as I thought I was going to be. But if instead you can say, oh, that's interesting. I'm really in terror right now. If you can, there's a part of the mind that can step back and just observe no matter what it is, period, no matter what it is, even if it's the most undharmic thing, you know, whatever it might be, if there's a part of the mind can just observe that, it's starting to loosen up that friction because friction, resistance, wanting things to be a certain way, wanting us to be a certain way, takes us further away from the deathless. The deathless has this is a profound embrace of whatever is present because there's no sense of separation or distance. And I think it's a really, when I started to get the knack of that, it's really loosened things up because before it's like, I would mess, you know, I would think, okay, I'm going to try to meet this challenge and I fail at it. And I think, oh, I'm a terrible Dharma student, you know, geez. You know. But the more I could say, oh, I just, that's how the mind went. You know, it's actually the question or the lesson is how not to resist that. So you learn how not to resist the fact that you're clinging, how not to resist the fact that you're craving or that you're becoming or that you're, you know, terrified of this or that. And what that does is it's really trying to address one of the main actions of the sense of self. And that's control. It's wanting to order the world, name the world. And it takes us in a different place, that sense of beyond words, beyond doing. And it's a mystery, you know, and it's a mystery. And, you know, all you need is that intention to find it. And you may learn a lot by going on those dead ends and realizing this doesn't work. Okay, this doesn't work. So what's left is just the release.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. All right, Dean.
Hi. You were talking about working with yourself and skin cancer, which is a very nice way to do things. But I found when I have things like that have arisen in my life that's like it would be really nice to be able to behave that way. But I'm most averse to meditation when something like that would come up and I can't get myself to sit. I was wondering what your practice would look like if it's a little too much to dive into.
Yes. Yeah. That's, you know, I think it's, I think a good default is to try to practice with things directly, but often life, you know, it's holding more than we can hold. It's more, our capacity to meet it is not there. You know, there's, remember this one story that Rodney shared about this, I think it was a Tibetan meditation master, and he had, you know, he was in the hospital. And he thought, okay, I'm just going to be able to open this and be present for it. And he said, you know, my mind was like a graveyard dog baying at the moon. It was completely, you know, unpeaceful, you know. And so I remember it was one time when my wife was in the hospital and, you know, had a very emergent thing going on. And, you know, of course, it's in the ER and it's the middle of the night. So there's all this waiting for the doctors and all that stuff. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try meditating with this. And it literally felt like I was dropping water on a hot skillet, that it just did not work. There's like no purchase because there was so much agitation, so much intensity that I couldn't find any kind of connection. And then I remembered something called metta, right? And, you know, my relationship to metta up to that point was like, you know, I don't really like it. It just seemed like I'm, you know, repeating words. It feels like I'm just, you know, digging a ditch. It doesn't feel like it doesn't have any juice or any use that I could see. But I, you know, people I respected always recommended trying metta. And so I switched from trying to just pay attention and be with to actually this intentionality of may you be safe, may you be peaceful. And that intention, something about the intentionality allowed me to make purchase, to actually make contact with the difficulty. And so that's can be one very helpful strategy, is to learn to turn toward that with that sense of intention like metta. Another strategy I find it's very helpful. I don't know if I ever taught it. I just tended to do it automatically. And I realized that maybe this isn't, I shouldn't assume that this is a strategy everyone does. And that's basically when I'm meeting something difficult, I'm also meeting a lot of other stuff in the moment that's not difficult, if that makes sense. So instead of being like this razor edge that's going right into the worst pain possible, it's much more of a much broader field that I'm holding the difficulty, the pain, the emotion, the situation with as equally as I can with the sound of the birds or the movement of the wind through the trees. And so that has the effect of really balancing the mindfulness itself. There's a sense of this broader thing that's holding it. And when something's really charged and painful, we tend to get that tunnel vision. We get like locked into it. And that's when it becomes really difficult. And so learning how, when to step back, when to open up to see it in a broader way. So there's, you know, two things I have found helpful.
Thank you. The second point was really helpful.
Oh, good. You're welcome, Dane. All right. Anyone else? You can either raise your blue hand if you raise your real hand, may not see you if I'm not on that screen, or you could just unmute yourself is fine too. Oh, hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to thank you for the bringing in the Carlos Castaneda side of this. That was the reading those books when I was much younger. That was the first time I'd ever had anyone introduce the notion that there was anything about death other than being terrified of it that existed. And you know, and I mean, this practice has been much about that, exploring that in a more directly, but I really appreciated the quote. It was a beautiful quote, and I remember that as a, you know, just a kind of a turning of, you know, and seeing something in a really different way for the first time. So thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, yeah, death is such a, I think the Buddha talked about like the different footprints of the teachings and how the death was really like the biggest footprint, like the elephant's footprint. And yet it's also, it's a very, you know, can really stir up a lot in us. So, you know, we have to really gauge, because there is so much fear around it. There is so much terror around our death, our demise. We have to see, okay, is this really helpful or not? And ideally, just as you noticed, that going from that terror to saying, well, actually, reflection on death starts to inform how I live my life. Actually, using, you know, the death off my left shoulder as an advisor. Not that's something I'm going to fight against and rebel against, but realizing that at some point outside of my control, I'm going to get that little tap and it's going to be games up kind of a thing. And to realize that, that actually that can be a way of informing my life and bringing that quality of urgency. So for, you know, each person, we have to kind of gauge how, you know, how ripe we are for that or how ready we are for that, and not to feel like we have to dive into death without it being, you know, if it was not ready for it, it's not the right teaching. And it is, you know, for many of us, it is a very profound one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, for some reason, in my own life experience, it just, it's kind of inseparable from Dharma practice. I think it just has an immediacy. Like when someone you know well dies, it brings, like that quote was saying, all the little things in life kind of fall away and you're just left with that, I don't know, the vastness and mystery of it. And it's just, it's very powerful.
Yes.
So, anyway, thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, you can deeply open things for us. I mean, we can see that death, too, is just, I mean, like each moment we're dying. Each moment there's these endings. And the more we can relax into it, the more we see that the stillness, you know, it's not so scary. So thank you, Peter, for sharing that. All right, anyone else? Yeah, Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like that, you know, thinking about death and the friend over your shoulder, I think of that as like becoming acquainted with death, and not just in like, but in real ways, when there is that brush, to really sit with that. And, you know, so for me anyway, it seems like the more acquainted I am with death as my advisor or something along that line, the more comfortable I'm going to be when when it's my time to go, when death is there. You know.
Anyway. Yes. Yeah. I think that's certainly the hope, is that it, you know, it allows us to become more familiar. You know, I think particularly, you know, things like life review, you know, really reexamining what things in our lives are unresolved, the unmet conversations. You know, what would feel like I can't let go because I haven't said that thing, I haven't made that amends or done what I needed to do. Because those are the things that's going to be hard to let go when you have the urgency of maybe a fast death approaching. And, you know, it's also something humbling, like, you know, the sense of being in the plane expecting to be able to just meet that fear easily. It can be very humbling when that actually meets us. And so being curious, like, what is it going to be like, as Mary Oliver said? You know, I want to step through that door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? So always keeping a humbleness around it, a curiosity around it. Thank you, Ron. All right, anyone else? Oh, I just finally understood. I got a text or a chat from someone saying, regardless of the teachings and learnings from your exercise, I hope it's benign. And I was thinking, well, the teaching's going to be benign, or I realized, oh, the results of the thing. I was wondering, as a teacher, when I give examples that are personal, you know, it's always a balance of trying to, you know, bring that personal connection, that sense of how things actually, you know, how you work with it. But also sometimes we get really focused on those. But yeah, it was benign. So it's all good for right now. So I have to find something else to scare me. I'm sure it will come unexpectedly. All right. Any last ones? All right. So I'll put out the information for support for Sims and for the teacher, for Donna. I get so kind of condensed with the way the chat does it. So again, thank you for your continued support of Sims, and also for myself and Tuari and all the teachers at Sims. And a reminder that we have, you know, sits in the mornings on Tuesdays, and actually Mondays, Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon, Thursday morning, and Friday morning. So those are nice chances to sit and practice, and, you know, bring forth any questions and that you might have. So next week we'll have a discussion around this. So play with that homework, you know, try to make it as playful as you can. It sometimes gets heavy, but have that sense of play, like, oh, wow, that mind state is just gone. What did I learn about its passing? And we can come back in a chance to explore that and speak what you've understood. All right. Have a wonderful week, and you're welcome to unmute yourself to say goodbye if you'd like.